The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Democrats only are guaranteed, maybe not even guaranteed, are only likely to have the Senate for 2 years, and they have a lot they want to get done in that period. And so it makes sense to me that they got what they could out of this, and now they're moving on to the rest of the agenda, and other processes are going to take on that accountability role because the Republican votes just weren't there for the Senate impeachment trial to have any other outcome than the one that did.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 17th, 2021. The impeachment trial of Donald J. Trump, that is the second impeachment trial of Donald J. Trump, is now over. It ended with a roar and then a whimper, and then a little bit of a roar again as seven Republicans joined all of the Democrats to convict the former president. It wasn't enough, as the Senate needs 67 votes to convict and only had 57, but it made a statement of sorts, or did it? Joining me to discuss the impeachment trial, its weird ending, and where it fits in with the effort to hold Donald Trump accountable are Lawfare Managing Editor Quinta Jurecic, Lawfare Chief Operating Officer David Priest, Senior Editor Scott Anderson, and our congressional guru, Molly Reynolds. We talked about how the impeachment trial ended and what it meant that the Senate voted to call witnesses and then didn't bother. We talked about how to interpret the Senate's performance overall in the second impeachment trial, and we talked about what the options are now that Donald Trump is a private citizen facing potential civil litigation, as well as criminal investigations and a possible 9/11-style commission. It's the Lawfare Podcast, February 17th, How the Impeachment Trial Ends.
David, get us started. This weekend, we were supposed to have nothing happened. We had something dramatic happened, which resolved quickly to having nothing happened. Does something dramatic dissolving into nothingness count as nothing, or did anything happen this weekend as the impeachment trial was winding down?
It was a lot of drama with no real payoff. And the problem with heightened expectations that lead to essentially the same result was, I mean, you could almost hear this collective sigh and feel the collective eye rolling as the prospect of witnesses was raised and then was squashed with no discernible gain other than what Jamie Raskin thinks is a real gain, which is getting on the record the president, through his defense team, stipulating that, yes, this conversation actually happened that was alluded to in the tweet the night before. That is a very small gain. I don't see much from it, given that the alternative was to push forward and see if any momentum changed because of the witnesses. As we've talked about before, I was not of the belief that there had to be witnesses for the core charge of what the president did before, what the president did on January 6th, and what the president did immediately thereafter. That was all public record for the core nature of the charge. you had made the case for witnesses, for fleshing out the record, and for highlighting more about the president's state of mind. I did not see it as necessary, but once you open that door, once you have a vote to do it, to then walk it back to me seemed like a mistake. I'll defer to Molly on the legislative aspects of this and the calendar, but the prospect of having perhaps weeks upon weeks of testimony from multiple witnesses, shutting down the confirmation hearings for the attorney general and others, and stopping all legislative business, I think that's a load of crap. I don't see how they couldn't do some legislative business each morning and then hold some of these sessions later on. It's not that hard to pass a relief bill once it's already been written by staff and worked out. So to me, it seemed like a real big missed opportunity to get more of the story out. And then, of course, the result, which seemed preordained, but certainly was not, was the actual vote to acquit the president. And perhaps we'll talk at more length about the scattered reasons that various Republican senators gave for an acquittal vote, whether appropriate or not.
Quinto, what did you think? Was this an example of exciting expectations merely to get to where we were going to be anyway, or was there something more to it than that?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I was watching it as closely as anyone, and it was a pretty confusing Saturday morning. I will say what made me feel a little better is that it seemed like for a pretty substantial stretch of time, none of the senators had any idea what was going on either. Again, I will also defer to Molly here. My impression from some of the reporting is that part of what happened may have been from a sort of failure of coordination between the House managers and the senators, such that the House sort of put the question of witnesses on the table, maybe without 100% running through with the senators what the plan was going to be and what the options were in terms of entering one statement into the record, which is what they did, hearing from one witness, hearing from a bunch of different witnesses. I think I will put myself in the camp of sort of people who were confused and perhaps a bit frustrated at the time. But as we go farther and farther away from the impeachment trial itself, I kind of think that I can make arguments on both sides, you know, that it was a huge mistake not to call witnesses in person or that it wasn't. It seems now to me like one of those things that maybe seems like a huge deal in the moment. But as we move farther and farther away, as the discussion focuses more on the fact of the acquittal and the question of what Congress does next, it may sort of fade in importance.
All right, we've had two people defer to Molly, and I happen to have Molly right here. So this is the Marshall McLuhan moment. Molly, what is it? Huge mistake, the vagaries of Senate process. Did the House managers throw the Democrats a curveball? What happened?
Yeah, so I think one really important point that this all illustrates is the degree to which the contemporary United States Senate does not function well in the face of uncertainty. When I was watching it live on Saturday morning, I joked that at least this time when the Senate was sort of melting down before our eyes because something unscripted was happening, they were doing it in the middle of the day as opposed to in the middle of the night, which was a reference to the last time that they did something that reminded me of this, which was when the Obamacare repeal failed on the floor in 2017, which is all to say that the current set of senators is only really used to things unfolding on the floor once they've been quite scripted to do so. And so it's hard to speculate about whether, like, who was at fault, whether someone made a mistake. For me, the biggest takeaway is just that these senators don't really know how to function in an entire environment of procedural uncertainty, which itself is a problem, and we should talk about that, but I think is separate from the sort of specific impeachment context. So one of the questions where David said he would defer to me was on kind of the legislative procedural aspects of this. And I do think there's something there on a kind of more technical procedural point, the degree to which Republicans could credibly threaten to derail Democrats' efforts to legislate and or confirm nominees. There's some pieces of that that my understanding is would have required unanimous consent to proceed with a robust legislative and nominations calendar while also doing a trial. And so that there are real questions about whether they would have been able to pull that off over a longer time horizon. I also think that if they had tried to go for more than just Representative Herrera Butler as a witness, that we might have ended up in questions about, you know, what if the witnesses don't want to comply? Might there be litigation, which could have dragged things out even further? And then the last thing I'll say is that I think the chance that Democrats would have started to lose some of the Republicans who did ultimately vote for conviction if they tried to push the trial longer. I don't know how real that possibility is, but I wouldn't dismiss it out of hand. That I think it is possible that some of the Republicans who did ultimately vote for conviction might have been less likely to do so if the trial had gone on longer and if the kind of overall atmosphere had changed with the introduction of witnesses.
So Scott, first of all, welcome back. You have watched this trial from the beginning without having to comment on it. So unlike the rest of us who have been sort of daily kind of offering thoughts, what is your impression of the aggregate of it?
That's a good question. You know, it is one of an interesting event where going in, the outcome seemed more or less predetermined. I think there was a moment, particularly shortly after January 6th, where the possibility of there actually being a conviction seemed real, but that faded somewhat quickly. And it became clear that 17 Republican votes were not going to be forthcoming. And then the question really became, well, what are Democrats hoping to get out of this? Is it to make a stance and make clear that by putting the president on trial, that articulate the facts, build the record to the public, makes a case to the public the president did something inappropriate? Is it to show that there's bipartisan support for this idea by bringing over a number of Republicans? And I honestly think on a number of those fronts, Democrats actually were very effective and successful. You know, Representative Raskin, I think, did a great job, really persuasive presentations on a variety of fronts. Has gotten a lot of, I think, due credit for that, as well as the other impeachment managers. Really did an exceptional job putting together a fairly concise case, laying out the facts that are themselves pretty damning. The president's defense team did no favors. I don't think anyone, despite what some Republican senators said at that last after the last bit of argument, no one was particularly persuaded by those arguments that they brought forward. Instead, Republicans were left to scramble for some technicality by which they could avoid voting against President Trump and settled on this very implausible and highly problematic as a precedent, if it stood as a precedent, although I don't think it really will, idea that, you know, the president can't be impeached or a president can't be impeached after leaving office, which for a variety of reasons that you guys have already covered in prior discussions is bupkis. But, you know, a final outcome where you actually had seven Republicans joining the Democrats to vote to impeach is actually pretty impressive. It's, I think, the most bipartisan, certainly presidential impeachment that we've seen, more bipartisan certainly than the Ukraine-related impeachment that we saw earlier. And, you know, a number of those are Republican senators. A few of them are retiring, Senator Toomey, you know, Senator Burr, but a number of them are going to be in the Senate moving forward. A few of them are kind of in those safer seats that they seem like they might be able to carry on even in the opposition of a Trump-backed sort of primary challenge, but not all of them. So, you know, it is actually kind of compelling, I think, that they were able to get that number of votes. And so it actually kind of got as good an outcome as you could hope for. I do think that limited range of outcomes may help explain a little bit the way this proceeded, and particularly that last call about witnesses that we were just discussing, for the simple reason that bringing in additional witnesses really helps if your goal is to bring out additional facts and build a more narrative to the public. But it doesn't really serve the other goals because it just seems so unlikely to actually change the outcome. Republicans had already embraced a very implausible way that is independent of the facts to avoid voting in a way they didn't want to, and that wasn't didn't seem likely to change, although we did see, obviously, you know, one or two senators waver a bit on that. Instead, you know, you would have been bringing more information to the public. That's a good, but it's not the only way to do it is through Senate impeachment. We've already seen the House move forward legislation to establish a 9/11 type commission for January 6th, which is another opportunity to bring forward a lot of facts, a lot of witnesses, do a lot of interviews, and frankly, bring it forward closer to 2024, when it may have more political salience if President Trump or people close to President Trump are trying to mount a recovery or a comeback to retake the White House. They also, we saw civil litigation filed today that is has the potential to secure a lot more information and witnesses and statements through the discovery process about some of these facts. So there's other ways to go forward. And ending the impeachment on a relatively quick time frame, as they did, this impeachment trial, frees up the Senate to do a lot of other things that the Biden administration needs it to do, particularly working on their nominees, which the Biden administration has only confirmed a handful of so far, and obviously has a lot of positions they need to fill in addition to COVID legislation and other items that are a priority. Right now, Democrats only are guaranteed, maybe not even guaranteed, are only likely to have the Senate for 2 years, and they have a lot they want to get done in that period. And so it makes sense to me that they got what they could out of this, and now they're moving on to the rest of the agenda, and other processes are going to take on that accountability role because the Republican votes just weren't there for the Senate impeachment trial to have any other outcome than the one that did.
All right. So you sound surprisingly upbeat about this. On a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is delighted and thrilled, and, you know, 1 is moping and in despair, where are you on the satisfaction with the Senate trial scale?
Well, it's all about where your expectations start. If I were on a kind of overall constitutional structure, a, you know, 1780 scale about how well this complies, which what I would hope would happen in this circumstance, I would be on below 5, I would think. You know, this is not what we expected the Senate to do. But from the perspective of the reality that we saw come about, you know, probably around prior to the inauguration, really, certainly in the weeks before the impeachment, so a January, you know, 17th / January 23rd sort of timeframe, where the fact that Republicans weren't willing to take this step had become clear, I think this is a 9 or a 10. You know, you got a number of Republican votes, kind of more than I was expecting, maybe not as much as would be ideal. And that's a ballot about as good as you can expect it, given the extremely tamped down realistic expectations from that time period. It doesn't mean the impeachment was effective in terms of constitutional design. I think there's a real concern there. But just in terms of the actual political actors pursuing it, I think they got what they could have expected out of it realistically.
Molly, what do you think as our institutional Senate person? Where are you on the satisfaction with process scale?
Yeah, so I'm probably not quite at a 9 or 10, but probably at a 7 or maybe an 8. I mean, I think for me, to go back to what I was talking about before in terms of the Senate not operating well in an environment of uncertainty, when we see that on display and when we see the consequences of that, that's troubling to me as someone who cares about the Senate as an institution. And given that the thing that kind of sent them into a little bit of a tailspin on Saturday morning was this statement from Representative Jamie Herrera Butler, that the kind of information contained in it was not new. She had said versions of this before, including to her sort of local newspaper, much more closely to the attack itself. And so in terms of kind of their ability to function in this environment, that I think is a place where they could have done better. And I would like to see, as a legislative body, I would like to see them be able to act more capably in a less constrained procedural environment than we did over the weekend. But to Scott's point, in terms of kind of the amount of Republican votes that it ultimately got, I do think that unless they were going to end up with 80 votes for impeachment, for conviction, that this is about as many as Democrats could have thought they were going to get. So in that sense, if that's the measure of success, then I do think we should think that things went well.
Quinta, where are you on the 1 to 10 scale of satisfaction with the Senate trial, and why?
I would say, like, I think I'm with Molly, maybe 7, like 6.5. I guess, look, as Scott said, it's important to keep this in context, right? I'm obviously, if I were, you know, parachuting in from a time machine and I just stepped out of 2014, I think I would be at like negative 40 because everything is in extremely bad shape. And it's appalling that only seven Republicans in the Senate voted to convict the president. On the other hand, from the point of view of 2021, seven Republicans in the Senate voted to convict the president. And that's six more than last time. So I think maybe what I'm trying to say is that I was pretty pessimistic about the odds that this was going to go anywhere in the first place. And so the fact that a bunch of Republicans jumped on board, not only to impeach the president in the first place, but then to convict him in the Senate, struck me as pretty good news, although I'm not so cheerful about it that I would say I think it, you know, bodes well for where we're going as a country or anything like that. So that's what's keeping me from climbing up into the higher numbers, but I'm definitely not feeling downbeat about it.
David, how about you? You're a an expert on getting rid of presidents. This president is already gotten rid of, but this was an effort to make sure he stayed gotten rid of. How satisfied are you on this scale with this outcome?
To use a phrase from our friend Charlie Sykes, I have just heard a whole lot of turd polishing here. I put it at a one or maybe a two if I'm feeling good. Let me explain this, because I was somebody who was finding myself, you know, fist pumping in the air and screaming when I heard that Senator Burr had voted to convict. So I definitely fell prey to that momentary feeling of, and there is truth behind it, that this is historic. You know, the first two impeachment trials of the president, there were no votes from the president's own party in the Senate to convict the president. And there was one last time, and suddenly we have seven, a whopping 14% of Senate Republicans, which is greater than happened in the House. 10 House members calculates out to something under 5% of all House Republicans voting to impeach in the first place. But let's look at what we have here. Let's step back and not just look at the number of votes compared to last time, but look at what happened. You had a president building up the case that any election loss he had would be rigged against him and the cause for some action. Then he did not win. He did not concede. In fact, he amped up his supporters, called them on a date. On that date, he told them to march on the Capitol using incendiary words, and people died. The constitutional process for confirming his successor as the next president was stalled. This is the kind of thing the founders were talking about, impeachment and removal by the Senate being a safeguard against things like a president possibly, you know, taking some cash from a foreign prince. We had something well beyond that here. And even with a, if not disastrous, a very disappointing defense by the president's own team, even with a ruling by the Senate that it had jurisdiction, you still had an acquittal of the president. This is abysmal. And I want to be optimistic. And I'm usually the voice of optimism. And hearing sixes, sevens, eights, and nines for this, the Senate utterly failed for what it was supposed to do. Remember, the Senate is not a legislative body when it is sitting in trial of a president. Senators take the separate oath in weighing the removal of an impeached president, and it has failed completely to transform them miraculously into impartial members of a constitutional jury. I think that the trial of the president should definitely be somewhere else, and would love to hear about a constitutional amendment to make it so.
So I am actually going to step out of my moderator role and weigh in on this. I'm with David, but for a slightly different reason, which is that in the face of a whole series of genuinely contested questions of fact, resolvable questions of fact, the Senate actually didn't do the job of holding a trial. It held opening arguments for a trial, and it held closing arguments for a trial.
Right.
And in between, it said, okay, now let's have a trial. No, never mind. Let's just go to closing arguments and a vote. And I think that is, that was a arguably defensible thing to do in the context of the Clinton impeachment, where there was a fully developed record. It was a completely indefensible thing to do in the case of the last impeachment. And it is equally indefensible in this case. And I do think it is very hard to give the Senate any credit for institutional performance here in the face of basically deciding in its unreviewable discretion, I mean, no one's going to tell it, you can't do it, that the power to try all impeachments includes the power to call a bunch of yapping a trial. Quinta.
Look, I think it's worth driving home that I'm speaking only for myself here, but that when I gave it a 7, I gave it a 7 for 2021. Like, I mean, it's as if we fell as a country into a pit that was a mile deep and we've climbed a couple yards up. We're still in the pit. But that said, you know, we're living in the pit now, and the pit is our home. And so I do think it's worth accepting that those few little measurements toward the sky are worth noting, even if, as you and David point out, we're still underground.
All right, Molly, I want to talk about your friend Mitch McConnell, who gave what I think is the strangest individual performance in this whole episode. Just to recap it, he voted that the Senate had no authority to hear the case after leaking in advance that he was glad that the House had impeached. He stalled the holding of the trial until the president was out of office, thereby setting up the complaint that the Senate had no jurisdiction. And then after voting to acquit, he proceeds to give a scorching, for Mitch McConnell anyway, speech on the Senate floor, essentially conceding that the facts are as bad as the House managers portrayed. How do you understand what Mitch McConnell was trying to do, thinks he was doing, and apparently did?
So my kind of guiding philosophy on Mitch McConnell, which it's possible I've talked about on the Lawfare podcast before, I'm not sure, is that his underlying motivation is always what will either win the majority for Republicans in the Senate or what will keep them in the majority, depending on the time. So right now we're in what will win us the majority in 2022 mode. And one thing that he does often in pursuit of that goal is to say things that can be read by others in any number of different ways, such that in the future, if he needs to be able to say, I was against Trump or I was for Trump and Republicans are against Trump or Republicans are for Trump, he's left open the ability to try and do that. And so I think what we've seen over the past 5 weeks or so from him on this is just trying to chart a course where if he needs to in the future, he can say he took any number of positions on the underlying issues of jurisdiction and constitutionality of holding a trial and on the facts, and just letting himself, again, have his words and actions read by other folks in any number of ways, however is most politically convenient and appropriate in the future.
So, Scott, one of the things you referred to earlier was other possible mechanisms available for accountability. I count three realistically if we're talking about January 6th specifically. One is federal criminal prosecution, which seems to me a remote possibility based on the current public record. But I suppose you could imagine the hundreds of criminal cases that are being filed producing cooperation that combined with further investigation yields some significantly disparaging information vis-a-vis the president's conduct. The second possibility is criminal prosecution in Georgia in relation to the former president's call with Brad Raffensperger. And the third is potential civil litigation, the first of which piece was filed today. How realistic do you think any of these are in Trump's immediate post-presidency period?
Well, it's two different questions as to whether these will apply just to Trump in terms of actually having legal consequences for him versus the prospect of doing the additional disclosures that I mentioned that you could have done with additional witnesses or other measures during the impeachment, getting more of the public record established, more fact-finding, kind of bringing forward additional information. On the latter front, I think all three are almost certain to do that. We do see a wide array of criminal prosecutions happening that are already bringing forward very useful information, a lot of which is fairly damning to the president and people close to him. Civil litigation seems likely to do the same. Whatever immunities and legal protections the president may have, private individuals do not have them. And the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, who were sued today alongside Rudy Giuliani and President Trump by the NAACP and other groups under a civil action under the Enforcement Act of 1871, they really are facing a real question as to whether they will be able to fight back against these legal claims where they really were engaged in problematic and in a lot of cases clearly detrimental behavior. And they're going to, at a minimum, it seems, face the possibility of having to defend their actions in court, produce documents about it in discovery, potentially face civil liability for it. And then, of course, we see the congressional front and this new 1/6 sort of commission that has come forward to say its whole purpose is to do more of these interviews. And the 9/11 commission was very effective at getting a lot of information, a lot of witnesses assembled and putting forward what became a fairly widely accepted narrative of the facts, less politically charged. I wouldn't be as optimistic as getting so much consensus around this report as that one did, or this commission's eventual report, but nonetheless pretty effective. In terms of individual legal consequences for President Trump, that's a much harder question. Prosecution, I think, seems fairly unlikely for the variety of legal issues that have complicated this in the past, and because politically it is just going to be a really, really divisive act to undertake. So barring a real open and shut case that has bipartisan support, which seems unlikely right now, I don't see the Biden administration likely to pursue it, particularly because there's lots of other legal actions being pursued against Trump around other issues, whether it's, state tax issues and things like that, that are kind of in place to hold him accountable on a variety of other fronts. Civil liability is, I think, a possibility, but likely going to be a problem because it's not so clear that what he was doing was outside the scope of his official duties. I think you could see an effort to show that it was because it was so clearly tied to campaign or private political activity, not presidential activities, wasn't funded by the executive branch, and therefore they'll make an argument to say that in fact this was private sort of conduct that should be civilly liable. But
and just to be clear, anything covered within the outer scope of the president's official responsibilities is protected by Nixon v. Fitzgerald, the Supreme Court decision, and the president is immune from civil liability for anything of that nature.
Exactly. And that's the question. Like, what is the line of the outer scope of presidential duties? There is a lot of executive branch sort of precedent, at least, and I believe it has certain parallels in the courts, although it doesn't come into the courts very often, drawing a line between what is a presidential role in terms of the office of the president versus a political campaign activity, often tied to who pays for it, and certain types of conduct. And it comes up in the context of the Hatch Act and what you can use, executive branch facilities and resources for. So there are efforts to draw these lines in other related contexts so you could see people kind of pull off of and potentially, if nothing else, argue, hey, we need more information about the president's role in these events on January 6th to determine whether or not he's immune and therefore might provide an avenue to get discovery and additional information, even if no claim ultimately sticks to the president on that. But that doesn't seem very likely otherwise at this point. And the avenue moving forward, I think, at this point really is a forward-looking one that's less about accountability for Trump, but to clearly draw lines problematizing the things Trump did, installing through Congress, through legislation, installing ethics rules, making clear that, you know, presidents have real limits on the ways they can abuse the security clearance process and, you know, withhold documents and do a variety of other things that the Trump administration did that was kind of beyond the pale, and move away from what had been a very norm-centered system towards one that has real legal limits, including for the president. And the real question comes down, I think is like the extent to which the Biden administration, Democrats in Congress, are able to really engage on that and enact those sorts of limits in an effective way, or whether they will choose to approach the Trump administration as kind of an anomaly and choose to kind of return to the status quo that was shown to be more vulnerable by the Trump administration. That's still an open question. I'm still optimistic. I think you'll see a real impetus for reform. I think you do see it among a lot of Democrats in Congress, but it is a long road to hoe before you actually get to legislation actually getting enacted.
David, what are your thoughts on the prospect for accountability for Trump going forward? Was this it and we just passed it up? Or does this door close and a dozen other doors remain open?
I'm more in the former camp. I think this largely was it for two reasons that have little to do with the merits of the case. You know, one is that former President Trump is not a young man. And we have seen, Don McGahn's subpoena for the first impeachment trial is now, going on 2 years or something like that. These things move very, very slowly. And given Donald Trump's history of throwing everything but the kitchen sink in a courtroom to delay and obfuscate, I just don't see anything rapid happening criminally or civilly in the time frame that's necessary for people to move on it. But I have low confidence in that because I'm not as up to speed on the various legal maneuverings other than the absolutely depressing experience of the last couple of years with congressional subpoenas for Trump and Trump administration officials. The other side of it is, I got to say, I've been seeing a lot of commentary now about things that I didn't even consider when I was reviewing all the ways of removing a president, because it didn't have to do with removal of a president. It had to do with, you know, punishing a president after he left office, such as Section 3 of the 14th Amendment or something in the U.S. code that would allow for disbarment from future office. If the political will wasn't there in the Senate to convict the president for this at the time, and if he's off of Twitter and not harassing them in public, yes, they'll still hear from Trump supporters about not supporting the president enough, absolutely. But I just don't see the political will for doing much against him because they think they can ride it out as they did for 4 years when he was at the pinnacle of power.
I find it really interesting that, Ben, that you were thinking of the impeachment as an option for sort of holding Trump accountable, because I never expected that the impeachment process was going to be a model for that, to the extent that I'm now wondering if I sort of missed something. I think because maybe this is a sign of my pessimism, I had always kind of assumed that, you know, the impeachment was pushed through quickly, the trial was going to be quick, people were going to want to get it out of the way, and so it wasn't going to be an opportunity for the kind of deeper soul searching that I think we need as a country in order to move past Trump. So, I mean, I think the options that everyone has discussed all make sense to me and I think are all viable and give a sense of how broad the landscape is of possible ways to hold Trump and those around him to account. It's striking to me that our understandings of what role the impeachment process could play were so different.
Well, I'm not honestly sure they were. I did not expect much to come from this either. But I do think any time the impeachment process is invoked, the right reference point for it is the role that it's supposed to play. And, you know, to go back to Scott's and your and Molly's expectations in 2021, I would argue that the right baseline of expectations is 1787, the system that we have for holding senior executive branch officials who refuse to resign accountable. And what we have learned through this process is that it actually doesn't work. And it doesn't work because the system is too polarized for the number 67 to be reachable. And therefore, it is too easy to survive it. And so I do worry coming out of this that the big lesson to everybody is high crimes and misdemeanors are actually survivable, provided that you don't violate the criminal law along the way, because you may have to answer for that after you leave office. But if it's just a question of the impeachment process, just hold your party together and you'll be fine. Scott.
Well, the only thing I would add to that is that if there's one thing we can take away from the last 4 years, it is the fact that a lot of these mechanisms we assume would step in these sorts of moments have really failed, or at least they didn't act do so very effectively. And if that's the case, that's why we really need to take this moment to not only reflect on accountability for Donald Trump as a person, but frankly, accountability for us as a republic. If we leave the status quo in place, we will be leaving in place a set of institutions that has not provided the democracy that we think we're entitled to, and set the limits on leaders that we think are necessary to preserve that democracy. And it's important that people step into the void and begin to enact new rules and legal limits that have a better chance of doing it. Constitutional amendment, probably not on the table. We're probably not going to change the impeachment process because the threshold is too high. But there is a legislative moment here in which we can do this if the Biden administration, Democrats in Congress, and hopefully some Republicans in Congress, I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility, get on board with doing that. In my mind, that more than anything is where attention is best turned towards this. That doesn't mean you don't look backwards. I think you have to look backwards and see what went wrong to figure out what you need to change in the future. But if we approach these questions strictly in terms of accountability for what happened in the past, we're going to leave open the risk that it's going to happen again in the future. And for me, that's the much bigger threat on the horizon that we need to spend our time addressing.
All right, we're going to do one more round of final thoughts. This is very likely our last Trump impeachment podcast of all times. We will, of course, reconvene when Biden is impeached for more impeachment podcasts. So, Molly, your final Lawfare podcast Trump impeachment thoughts, you go first.
First, I'll say that I'll be glad if I don't have to reopen the Senate's impeachment trial rules for more than a year in the future. That would allow me more time to consider other Senate procedure questions. But I think that I just want to come back to kind of what Scott was just saying and tie it back into something that David said earlier when he was talking about how long it's taken to try and enforce the subpoena from the first impeachment trial against Donald McGahn, which is that's the kind of thing that I think we need to be spending a lot of time focused on right now, which is how do we make Congress more capable at getting information that it needs to do its job from the executive branch? And sometimes that involves things as high profile as impeachment trials and the subpoenas associated with them. But in a lot of other cases, it involves things that don't grab the headlines, but are still really critical for Congress to be able to do its job in all kinds of policy areas. I can say, for example, that right now there are a lot of committees, particularly in the House, that are attempting to get information from executive branch agencies about, you know, what the Trump administration was doing for the past year plus on COVID that they couldn't get when Trump was in office. And so there's a bigger conversation here about the imbalance of power and the ability of Congress to exercise its constitutional responsibilities that I think is one of the big lessons we should take away from having lived through two presidential impeachments basically in 1 year.
David Preece, your final thoughts on Trump impeachments.
Yeah, the first Trump impeachment was certainly bad. That is, you know, using the powers of the presidency for personal political advantage and affecting national security. That's bad. The second Trump impeachment was something quite different. It was something attacking the constitutional order itself and inviting, if not inciting, the use of political violence to achieve what could not be achieved within the regular order. that is the part that has me worried. And yes, it's because I'm also reading The Storm Before the Storm by Mike Duncan about the Roman Republic. And when the norms of peaceful assemblies and things first were broken, that the precedent was established that political violence could happen and could go unpunished, which made it more likely for the next one and the next one. And I've got to think that what's important now, even if Trump is not held personally accountable in some way, for a new consensus to develop around the fact that, yes, we were not able to convict the president for various reasons, most of them fig leaves. But we must have a consensus that political violence to achieve ends that are unachievable within the constitutional order, that's unacceptable. We can't let this become the precedent, or else I fear that in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, the next time there's something like this, the shock value is gone, and it becomes easier to accept, well, you know, we didn't actually overthrow the constitutional order this time. They disrupted and they delayed the Senate procedure, but they didn't stop it, so it's okay. The system worked. Well, what is it that next time is going to be okay? Well, you know, they did actually delay the inauguration of the next president, but it was only by a few months and everything worked out okay. The system held. Well, the system's not holding if you get to that point. So my concern and what I'm looking for is for people across party lines, and maybe this is people like the Ben Sasse, the Adam Kinzinger, the Liz Cheneys, coming together with like-minded Democrats and saying, look, apart from everything having to do with immigration and marginal tax rates and the level of relief in the next stimulus bill, let's come together and try to reimagine what's necessary to build a consensus around the lack of political violence in our system. That's my main worry. And you notice that that all happens without Trump, whether Trump is in the picture or not in the future. It's that norm breaking down that has me most concerned and where we need the most political action from forward-thinking people who are elected to these positions.
Quinta Jurecic, your final impeachment thoughts.
I think it's interesting to put this impeachment not only in context of the last impeachment, as David just did, but also in the context of the Mueller investigation, because I think that progression is a useful way to sort of see patterns in how Trump's behaved. So all of these three instances involved Trump either trying to cheat or trying to swing an election in his favor. And they all involved at some point or other him trying to sort of use the powers of the presidency for personal advantage in that way. I think that the as we go from 2016 to 2019 to 2020 and 2021, what we see is that in some ways, Trump's tactics become a lot more brazen and aggressive. You know, he moves from accepting foreign help that's offered to seeking out foreign help and bullying an allied country for it, and then just to inciting violence on his own colleagues in Congress. What that drives home for me is that he, you know, he pushes the line, right? As Dan Dresner has written, he's like a toddler and he'll see how much he can get away with. And I think it is unsurprising that we ended up here, given that Congress was unwilling to impeach him in the Mueller case, convict him in the Ukraine case, that he sort of pushed the line all the way up to the Capitol itself. On the other hand, you know, maybe it shouldn't be so surprising that members of Congress sort of finally took action only when their lives were at risk, as opposed to, say, the life of, you know, a Ukrainian soldier on the front lines in the Donbass. I have to say that that doesn't fill me with optimism about where we're headed, insofar as, you know, the more abstract the threat that Trump poses, the less Republicans seem to be willing to respond. The Capitol was obviously very, very urgent and concrete, but as time moves forward, it becomes easier and easier to brush off. And so I do worry that that sort of urgency and memory of how immediate and violent it was will recede, so too with a willingness to push back against him in any way. We'll see.
We are going to leave it there. Quinta Jurecic, David Priest, Molly Reynolds, Scott Anderson, thank you all for joining us today and every day that we have covered impeachments on the Lawfare Podcast. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the redoubtable Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our promotion manager is you, the listener, so get out there, tweet about us, share us on Facebook, pin us on Pinterest, upvote us on Reddit, and for heaven's sakes, leave a rating or review wherever you found us. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, and as always, thanks for listening.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.